watching United 93 on the TV. Anybody remember United 93? It's an older movie now. It was the story of the airliner in 9/11 that they took over and crashed into the plane around and headed to the Capitol. That came out not long after 9/11. And Sam had never seen it. So I'm upstairs trying to work, and downstairs, you know, through the floorboards, I can hear, you know, fear, death, and agony, you know, as people are sacrificing themselves to save others and bring down the plane. You don't realize how loud the TV is till you're upstairs and nobody's watching. And I'm hearing this kind of subliminally, and I'm like, you know, some people find meaning and purpose in times of crisis. But it's in the last moments of their lives that they find out what they're made of. And we rightly call those people healers. They have the bravery and courage and selflessness. People who are put in those kinds of crux of situations where they all of a sudden have to rise to the best of who they could possibly be. And they behave the way we wish we would in a similar situation. Of course, none of us actually want to ever be in those situations. We don't really want to test it. So we call them heroes. And they are. This story for today is absolutely kind of on the other end of that spectrum, really. Gary Monday, a very ordinary, these people are doing what they've been doing for years since they could follow their dad out on the boat. The fishermen disciples. Now, the disciples have met the resurrected Jesus now several times. This one says it's the third time that they've seen Jesus. And they've been extraordinary moments, that's to be sure. But Jesus is, it's kind of a nice scene, now you don't. He appears, he disappears, he reappears over here. I mean, it's this kind of thing. The disciples are not sure what's going to happen next. They're very up in the air. I mean, wouldn't you have a little bit of free-floating anxiety if you never knew when this guy who's dead is now alive is going to keep showing up in places? I mean, that's a little weird. So they're unsure. They haven't really been asked to do anything yet, except they need to wait for the power of God. And so they're not really sure what to do, and I love, it reminds me of this axiom that, you know, I've been convicting myself of lately. You know, when we don't know what to do next, we do what we know, you know? And so they're doing what they know. They've gone back to familiar territory, gone home, they've left Jerusalem, they're back up in the woods, so to speak, up in the Sea of Galilee, they're back to their familiar roles, they're back to their familiar job of fishing, they're back to their familiar routine, and the ordinary frustrations of life. You know, here they were hiding out from the Roman guards, and now they're just worried about the fact that they couldn't fish last night. You know, I mean, they're really kind of shrinking back in. And nighttime is the best time for fishing, but not this night. And you have to wonder if they were at all suspicious when this stranger is on the seashore and says, "Hey, cast your net on the right." And of course, this is a translation. Sam and I were saying, well, wouldn't you send like starboard or something like that? But anyway, that's here and here. The right just seems like not very knowledgeable. But would they have recalled the last time someone said something like this? Does this story all sound familiar to you? It should. Luke chapter 5, way back at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, there he is on the lake, on the Sea of Galilee. The people are crowding around, and Jesus is at the water's edge, and there's a couple of boats there. And he's trying to teach, and he actually gets in one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and he asks this guy, this fisherman, "Hey, would you put your boat out a little bit so I can talk to the people?" And he sat down and talked to people on the boat. And when he finished, he said to Simon, "Put out in the deep water and let's let the nets down for a catch." And Simon said, "Master, we have been hard at work all night, and we haven't caught a thing. But because you say so, we'll go try." And remember, they are not yet Jesus' disciples. They're just kind of needed. So they go out, they put down the nets, and they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners on the other side of the boat to come and help, and they came, and they filled both boats so full that they began to sink. And when Simon saw this, he fell at Jesus and he said, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." That time, in that miracle of the fish, Simon said, "Get away from me. I'm a sinful person." And Jesus said to Simon at that time, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people. Come and follow me." So, this has happened before. This has happened before. And at some point, you know, they finally get it. They don't think they get it until the net was too full to haul into the boat. They go, "Oh, yeah." The disciple whom Jesus loved, who was John, said, "Oh, here he is again." Peter jumps in the water. Everything starts to happen pretty quickly. You can see there. There's so many other things to focus on in this story. This story is so incredibly rich. I'm just going to focus on just one or two. So many things that are interesting about this story. One of the things I find interesting is that Jesus already has a fire ready. And what does he have on the fire? Fish. Where did he get the fish? He didn't really eat the other 153 fish. And the miracle that the fishermen remember most, that they write down in the story that they don't want to forget, the net was not poor. Now, to you and me, we go, "Yeah, whatever." But that's a contrast between the first story and the second story. It's so full, and yet the net was not poor. Almost as if the fish were just kind of compliant and not struggling, or we don't know. But for the fishermen, like, that was part of the miracle. And why would we believe this? And that won't even hold. Like, we don't even have to fix it. And there's all these allusions here to catching fish and catching men. I can't even get into it. People are in the scene. Then, three times, Jesus says to Peter something like this: "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" Exasperates Peter, this repetition. And we understand where this repetition comes from. It's to counter Peter's denial, right? When he betrayed him and the cock crowing, right? All that kind of stuff. But I have a couple questions for you again that kind of jump out at me. What does Jesus call Peter? Simon. He calls him Simon, son of John. Not Peter. He goes back to the old name. Simon's gone back to his old job, his old life. So Jesus calls him by his old name, Simon, son of John, not Peter, the rock on whom I shall build my church. In this moment, Jesus is giving Peter a choice. Which life are you going to lead? You're going to be Peter? You're going to be Simon? Who are you going to be? Which path are you going to take in the future? That's significant. The other thing he says, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" What's the these? What do you think, Will?
The fish.
I think you're right. I think it's the fish. We don't know. The Greek is unclear. Is it more than these, the disciples? Is it more? What is it more than these? I think it's the fish. Particularly because why would we know there's 153? What point did that detail serve? Perhaps when you say there was a lot more than these. Again, Jesus is asking Peter, "What's your true love? Catching fish? Catching people? Catching fish? Following me?" Back to that original invitation when they met on the beach the first time, "Come and I will make you fishers of men." Peter, where's your heart? Are you here with the fish? Or are you going to be out there with my lambs? Which is, again, interesting. He's got a fishing image and he's got a very image of that. But there's nothing wrong with fishing. I want to say that clearly. There's nothing wrong with fishing. Jesus blessed it with a full catch. But Jesus is saying, now it's time to choose. And he speaks specifically to Peter because Peter is the leader. He is the rock on which Jesus intends to build his church. If Peter insists on going back to fishing, guess what? The others will probably disperse as well. He is pivotal in this moment. And so it's Peter that Jesus goes to and says, "Hey, Which way do you love me? Can you follow me? And what does that follow look like? And what does that follow look like for you and for me? I have a skiing analogy. I always turn light on the skiing analogies, but I think I can do this one without mucking it up too much. I watch a lot of parents out there on the birches with their little kids. I have a perfect view from my office. I sit at my desk, I can turn around, and there's a beautiful big window. This time here, there's no leaves. I can sit there and sit. There are many different techniques for parents to teach their kids how to ski. They vary widely. Some are more successful than others. Anybody watch Warren Miller films? You could film some great Warren Miller footage right from Warren Miller because it's where you start from the soccer scene. Many different kinds of relationships between parents and children. But there is somewhat of a common pattern. Goes something like this, more or less. Very, very early, the parent may actually carry the child in their arms to get the feeling of gliding down the little birch's slope. Get the sense of, you know, gliding, get the little sense of speed. We did not do this. I don't think we ever did this with our kids because we did not want to encourage this. We wanted them to carry their weight and their leader. But I've seen it a number of times. The next one is, and you've seen this a lot, the child stands between the legs of the parent. Or the responsible adults. And the child is cushioned and protected, and they are held up, they rely on the strength of the parents. The parent also gets to control the speed, which is very good. Hey, you've seen that one, right? Everybody's seen that one. Next one. I'm not saying this is how, by the way, not when I'm just saying this is the way parents do it. Next one. Child stands beside the parents. Like holding on to a pole or something like that. Any kind of fancy pole you can buy. Really fancy one. Usually a ski pole, but you can get this funny one with these kind of poles. And they ski together, and the parent is still what? The parent's still in control, right? And the parent decides when they're going to turn, where they're going to turn. Because you can pretty much force a little kid to stand beside you on the pole when and where you turn. But the child holds up their weight, being a little bit more independent, feeling a little bit, feeling the smell a little bit more, right? The parent trusts the kid to hold on to the pole. There is a trust there. They usually hold on to the pole. And also a nice little, the parent really is still in control, but there's some trust. How many of you ever tried the next one? Or for the alternate one, the leash. Follow me. Some parents missed this step. much to your detriment. They said, okay, it's me. They just kind of let them go. And trust me, I see it. But the next one is Farley. And the parent skis the hill in broad, slow turns, and the child is trusted to fall. Now, what are the choices now open to the child? What could they do at this juncture?
Tuck.
Absolutely. They can ski straight down the slope, ignoring all obstructions for the freedom of the speed. They have that choice. What else do they do? They could follow the path of the parent and make those lonely turns. They can also take another path and still make turns, but not actually follow the parent. There's also another one. There's also a fourth choice.
They can just stop.
Exactly. They can just lay down in the snow and eat it, which we see a lot too. We've all seen that. So think about it. It's a great analogy. For 3 years, Jesus has taught his disciples by word and deed. He was with them almost every waking minute, right? Intensely with them for 3 years. And he began that time with a call, come and follow me. And he ends his earthly time with them by saying what? Feed my sheep. You've been watching me. You've been following in my steps. You've been doing what I do. Now, let go of the rope. It's your turn. Feed my sheep. Or now he says, go and tell. Simple thing. Jesus is trusting them, trusting Peter, trusting us to follow in his footsteps. We cannot see Jesus in a physical realm, but we with our spiritual eyes can certainly see where he's going. We can see the signs of his presence which are all around us. We can watch for those tracks in the snow and see where he is and where he's calling us. Anytime that you go, but I don't know where Jesus wants me to go, I don't know what Jesus wants me to do, it's just really clear, love your neighbor as yourself, love your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Take care of the widows and orphans and the strangers in your land. If you lose track of that, you can't figure out who comes out, remind you. That's it. That's right, that's what it is right there. We're sitting around looking for a specific will of God, and we're like, should I have chicken and beef for dinner? Love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, and mind, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. Take care of the widows and the orphans. Take care of the stranger amongst you. You are good to go. Now, Jesus, I wonder if he's chuckling or if he's mad, but the next little part, the last part. He tells Peter, and I give him credit for this, doesn't hold back, says to Peter what? This is how it's going to end. This is how you're going to go. This is how you're going to die. And yet, still, he says, follow me. Gotta love Peter. What does Peter do? It's what you and I love to do. Looks at the other guy and says, what about him? Don't we love to deflect like that? What about him? Now, what are you going to do with him? What do you want him to do? And Jesus says, don't worry about him. You must follow me. And then there's that wonderful picture thing. If you want to hire my people, I'm telling some business of yours. Just don't worry about him. You follow me. It's not our task to worry about what others are doing or not doing for the Lord. His record is crystal clear to us. We are called to follow. It doesn't matter what the person next to you is doing. For me, this story kind of compresses into something really basic. For me, this reminds me of God gives me second chances. You know? Peter messed up, we messed up. God gives us second chances. We get to try this again and again and again. The next one is that if we follow him, God will provide. You know, they were all proud of those 153 fish, but Jesus already had fish on the fire. If we follow Jesus, God really does work with the rest of the provisions of our life. That doesn't mean we don't have to show up and do our job. That doesn't mean that there won't be time to struggle, but all that struggle is transformed into our life in God. You get closer in your life in God when your finances are tight. You get closer in your life in God when you lose your job, just the way it is. So we can trust God, that God, in that sense, is in the provision. But the third one, which I don't want you to skip or miss, is we do have to be aware of the idolatry of the Peter was going back to what he knew. We have to be careful that in the doing what we know, we don't make that bigger in our lives than what Jesus is calling us to be about. Because in the end, no one can live our lives in Christ except for us. So in this post-Easter time, will you go back to what you know, or will you follow Jesus further out? And what would it look like for you to follow Jesus further out to feed these lambs? You know, what safety net, if you will, to borrow our language, what safety net is Jesus inviting you to let go of? Do you love the safety of your 153 fish or whatever you got in your bank account or whatever that is more than Jesus? Do you love him more than fishing? That's what he says. Are you ready to stop working just for yourself and start making my call your first purpose? Now, Peter said yes. We know he said yes because of the rest of the biblical witness. And he spent the rest of his life serving God. But this is a question that we have to ask ourselves. And I love the way Jesus was honest with Peter. Not all sunshine and roses. But Peter never regretted his choice. Never regretted his choice. I never regretted my choice to follow him. But I have to choose it again every day. Some days I make better choices. And what choice will you make? What does it mean to make that choice? What does it really mean to put Jesus first rather than 153 fish or $153 in the bank account, whatever, 153 children? What's that? And you just gotta do it. One of the quotes that I often keep near me, which is not a Christian quote at all, was a guy who was a writer. Let me take a funny friend. Newspaper columnist in Chicago, a guy named Sidney Harris. People were asking him about writing and the writing process. And someone asked him, Mr. Harris, what do you do when you don't feel like writing? And he said, I write. That's the difference between an amateur and a professional. I write even when I don't feel like it. And I think that's a good word for us as people of faith. We do what we are. We are people of faith, and that's how we are going to live this life. I don't often have an altar call. A call to recommitment, but I felt today was an important day to do that. In light of this story, if you'd like to say today, no, Lord, I've been squandering my days, so I want to put you first in my life. This is a day for you to do that in your head and in your heart with God. If you've never said, hey, I want to follow God with my life, this is a day for you to do that too. Because this verse, this story calls us to decide. It is a day of decision. It is a day of decision for Peter. They have a huge future for him. And today is a day of future for you. We're going to sing one of the classic songs, which I learned something new about just yesterday. I have decided to follow Jesus. I always thought this is an American folk tune. Guess where it came from? Some people already know that I told this story. India. This song was originally played on the sitar. We don't have any sitar players. Several stories about its origin. Shrouded in history. One of the stories is comes from that tree.